This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I said this a couple of days ago, and it turns out I was right. Even though we knew that jobs number was going to be big, it still hurt to see it actually land. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, I do believe the 8th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, every once in a rare while on a Friday, there is news of such bigness that we start with it and get to our analysis of the week that was a couple of minutes into the program. And today clearly is one of those days. A terrible, horrible, no good, very bad April for the American labor market. More than 20 million jobs lost, unemployment at 14.7%. Prospects so bad that people are just dropping out of the labor force altogether. And look, we get that there can be such a thing as too much bad news. People might just tune out, right? Well, don't do that, because one of the things you got to know, don't do it on principle, but one of the things you got to know about today's report is that there are not great tidings in it about how many people who are out of work right now might be able to get back to work. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
The number of Americans who are out of work and counted as unemployed tripled in April, sending the unemployment rate soaring. But, says Donald Marin at the Urban Institute,
a bunch of people reported that they were employed but absent from work. They didn't show up in the unemployment rate.
It's people like Amber Bradshaw. In mid-April, she was furloughed, temporarily laid off from her job at a furniture store in Texas. She got on unemployment, but she says,
I did still feel like I worked for the company and was coming back to work.
So she still considered herself employed. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says most people who said they were on leave from a job were actually, like Bradshaw, on temporary layoff. Add them in, and the BLS says unemployment would be higher, almost 20%. Amber Bradshaw is back at work. Her store near Dallas reopened. In fact, most people on layoff think they'll be punching in again soon. Three-quarters of the unemployed characterized their layoff as temporary in the April jobs report. But Marin says temporary has a way of becoming permanent.
You know, it's one thing to think you'll be recalled when we're in the first few weeks of a crisis. How are these people going to feel about their situation when we get a month or two into the future?
Stanford economist Nicholas Bloom says the record's not good.
Temporary layoffs that last more than 2 months are much more likely to become permanent. If we're in a recession for another 6 months or a year, it's going to be very hard to bring these jobs back.
And Bloom estimates 13 million of the jobs we've already lost likely aren't coming back. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, now the analysis of the 5 days gone by. Anna Swanson is at the New York Times. David Gura is at MSNBC. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
So, David, let me start with this. And unless you feel the need to opine on the jobs report, we had Mitchell. We're doing some more stuff later in the program. I would just as soon gloss by it and ask you this. Explain for us, if you could, the fact of the market disconnect from reality, right? Millions and millions and millions of people out of work, and yet investors are like, yeah, everything's good. Discuss.
I will play market psychologist here a little bit. It is a yawning disconnect, as you say. And of course, this is something that the president is so fond of using as a metric, and something I know that you decry time and time again, making the very key point here that the market is not the economy, the economy is not the market. I think that there's just a lot of short-termism when it comes to the stock market. I know that Paul Krugman made the point in recent days that the economist Paul Krugman made the point in recent days that, you know, bonds are so cheap, there just aren't a whole lot of places for people to put their money. Maybe that's why they're going to stocks. But I do think that there's this kind of short-term optimism as, you know, all of this sets in. We're in week 8 of all of this, that things are bound to get better at some point. We see some states opening up. Maybe that gives some investors some optimism. That's all I can think about here. But I do think the disconnect is wide. Yes.
The things are going to get better at some point, School of Investment Management. I love that
yes.
one. Anna, let me ask you this, and it's a global question, right? The EU said this week we're looking at the worst time since the Great Depression. Yes, of course we are. So the question is, with China back in gear but not really back in gear and everybody else getting whacked, who or what gets us out of this? You know how in previous recessions you've looked for, you know, engines that could – I'm going to guess Anna went away.
Oh, all right, David, can you hear me?
You ready? Oh, there
can
we
you
are.
Hear me?
There she is. Go
oh,
ahead.
Sorry,
yes,
you
go ahead.
You disappeared for a second, but I think I know where you were going with that. So let me just say, I mean, you know, looking out around the world, it's kind of a question of, you know, who's in worse shape than the next.
Right.
You know, for the European economy, the projections were that they would shrink by 7.4% this year, the deepest recession in EU history. I think that's going to lead to a lot of, you know, tension within the EU about, you know, the Eurozone itself. So, you know, we may not be looking to the EU to lead. China still has a lot of questions about its credibility over its handling of the coronavirus. The United States doesn't look like it's really that eager to lead either. So, you know, the last economic crisis really fueled some populist movements, and it looks like maybe we're headed toward kind of a more fractured, protectionist kind of populist period anyway.
Yeah, hold that thought. David, I want to get to you, and I want to ask you about the president today and his chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, who said, even as bad as things are, the president verbatim said, I'm in no rush to do a new stimulus plan. Kudlow says we're going to wait to see what the effects of these states that are opening is going to do. What do you make of that?
You know, a lot of the economists that I talk to have made the point over and over again that there's going to be a need for more stimulus here. They've even rejected that term, that what we've seen Congress doing in recent weeks is just building a bridge here, trying to get us through this as best they can. And again, they've emphasized over and over again, Congress is going to have to do more. I was a bit worried about this as the president started to make the case for opening up the economy fast, that it's going to sort of distract from the real issues at play here. I mean, we know that states are in pretty bad shape and likely to get in worse shape. And as we talk about where this unemployment rate and the unemployment picture might be headed, state governments are going to be facing some pretty hard choices here in recent weeks. But I was talking or trying to guess here what the stock market was thinking. I mean, a lot of that optimism there among investors, I guess, is something that's native to or known by Larry Kudlow. He is of that. And I think that he is optimistic something's going to happen. I mean, just going back to what Mitchell said in his fine piece at the top of the show, I mean, a real issue here is timing. And I think economists are eager to make the point that when people lose jobs, the longer they have to wait, you know, the longer they wait, the harder it is to get those jobs back. And when you look at the fiscal policy that's been put into place here and the monetary policy, there was a move here in light of what we've learned from past recessions to go fast this time around. And the reason for doing that is, you know, try to speed this up as much as possible because those links between employer and employee become more and more tenuous as time goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, Anna, so to the president's agenda and your final thought there about populism and unilateralism. The president is clear that he favors this country withdrawing from a lot of international alliances. I guess my question is, do you suppose that this crisis in the global trend that has been toward unilateralism just exacerbates that and accelerates it?
Yeah, I actually do think that this is naturally time where, you know, countries are turning inward. They're thinking about their own economic prospects. They're trying to grab up, you know, products that they would typically be exporting, like medical products and food. There's naturally kind of a race to the bottom. And, you know, you do have the kind of the erosion of some international organizations, too, like the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization. So there isn't a lot of, you know, goodwill and generosity to go around right now. And I do worry that this is going to lead to deeper divisions that, you know, undermine the position of international organizations, of the European Union, of these structures that depend on, you know, goodwill and generosity.
Yeah. And of the United States in it, right? I mean, that's kind of the deal. Anna Swanson at the New York Times. David Gura, he is with MSNBC. Thanks, you too. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Kai. You too.
Thanks.
All right. Talk to you soon. Okay, look, we talked about it today. Gura did. We talked about it yesterday, and we are going to be talking about it Monday. I promise you, Wall Street has become decoupled, I think is the phrase, from the real economy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you don't have a job, it's tough to pay rent. So it stands to reason, with all those job losses, that there's a whole lot of rents not being paid. A week into May, at least 20% of renters have yet to make any payment for the month. That's from a group that represents big landlords, it should be said. And a whole lot more people, that group says, didn't pay the full amount. But the numbers are actually a lot better than people had been guessing. For now. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on that one.
Forget this month's rent. Jonah Montoya is still trying to come up with $825 for last month.
I am like nickel and diming everything.
Montoya is 24 and shares an apartment in Astoria, Queens. He's been furloughed from his job as a barista since March. He got his $1,200 stimulus money and his first $600 pandemic unemployment check. But he also has to pay for utilities, food, and other essentials.
Kind of feels like you're on your own and you just have to like figure it out how to survive and how to like stay sane at the same time and like stay motivated.
Given situations like that, landlords are surprised how many people have paid their rent this month. Doug Bibby is president of the National Multifamily Housing Council. He says the 80% of households that paid on time is down only 1.5 percentage points from this time last year. The group represents owners of professionally managed apartments, which skew toward more affluent tenants. And Bibby says many landlords have reduced rent or worked out payment plans. But he also expects things to get worse.
With this number of unemployed and with the economy at a standstill right now, I just can't see this trend continuing.
A recent Marketplace Edison research poll found that 62% of renters are worried about being able to pay. And Seamus Roller with the National Housing Law Project says paying the rent leaves less for everything else.
It means that you're spending less on food, scrimping on medical bills and things like that.
And while most communities have some kind of moratorium on evictions, protections vary widely, and some of them are already being lifted. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
We did some reporting when the first round of the Paycheck Protection Program ran out of money about who got those loans and where those companies were. With the second round of small business money making its way out into the economy, it's becoming clear that the states that did the worst in the first round are having some better luck in round two. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on the PPP beat.
During the first round of the PPP, Alexandra Mason had a hard time getting a loan. She runs a marketing consultancy in Washington, D.C. One bank rejected her application, another approved the request, but never sent the money. But after round two kicked off last week, she applied again.
Within 3 days, including a weekend, my approval came through and was funded.
As of May 1st, Washington, D.C., New York, New Jersey, and California are getting a greater share of loan approvals relative to their share of the U.S. population. John Kabatek is California State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business. He says those states benefited from new guidance favoring smaller companies that applied.
Too much of this money was going out to businesses that needed it less.
Customers in those states are also more likely to bank with larger institutions, says Ernie Tedeschi, an economist with Evercore ISI. In the first round of funding, that was a disadvantage, since community banks in rural states saw the most success. But in the second,
that trend has been reversed a little bit.
Bigger banks had more advantages in the second round, like the option to upload applications in bulk. Tedeschi says banks in coastal states likely had time to process loans after the first round of funding ran dry.
You know, sort of finalizing applications and getting them ready for the eventuality of more appropriations coming.
The Small Business Administration says 53% of approved dollars in the second round came from banks with more than $50 billion in assets. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Coming up.
Pretty much life is normal, which is disturbing, but I guess slightly comforting.
A disturbing and slightly comforting all at the same time dispatch from Taipei. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. We talked about this. Dow Industrial's up 455 today, 1.9%, 24,331. The NASDAQ up 141 points, 1.5%, ended things at 91.21. S&P 500 up 48, 1.6%, 29.29. For the week, the Dow up 2.5%, the NASDAQ boosted 6%, the S&P 500 advanced 3.5%. You can't see me right now, but I'm doing one of those shruggy things. We've been tracking oil for you. Futures up about 25% on the week. Brent crude, that's the international benchmark, topped off today at about $31 a barrel. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note up to 0.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back to the jobs report for just a couple of minutes now. More than 20 million jobs vaporized last month, 14.7% on the rate, as I said. Those are the headlines. Scroll with me, though, if you would, to the bottom of the employment situation summary. That's the official name of the jobs report. Go to table B in today's report, and you will find a couple of lines to which we would like to draw your attention.
The diffusion index.
Economist John Mullins is with the Current Employment Statistics Program at the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
You know, it's not the first thing people look at, but it does present another picture of what's happening in employment.
Which is why we are here. Another picture, another way to think about all this stuff. The diffusion index measures how widely a given month's job gains or losses, it should be said, are spread across industries. A number above 50 means more industries added jobs than lost them. Below 50, more industries lost than gained, right? It's about the breadth of the job losses. The April preliminary number, 4.8. March was 28.5, 53.7 back in February.
I really almost don't have words to express how mind-bogglingly widespread this job loss is.
That's Martha Gimbel. She's the manager of economic research at Schmidt Futures. And I know you're wondering about the Great Recession and how today compares. The low back then was April 2009, 15.5. Remember, 50 is the break even. So the 4.8 this month
means that almost no industries were able to actually add jobs in this environment. And in fact, so few industries were able to add jobs that I can just list them.
No, go ahead, please.
General merchandise stores actually had very strong growth. And then it was just the federal government, couriers and messengers, computer and peripheral equipment, other information services, and monetary authority, central bank. That's it.
That's it.
Even in the height of the Great Recession, you still had people making some purchases, and that was, you know, lifting up even those horrible job numbers. Right now, there really is just no place to hide.
That's the thing the diffusion index is telling us. The lost jobs aren't concentrated just in leisure and hospitality, because even if you've got a job you can do from home,
unfortunately, someone has to pay you to do that job. And if there's an overall economic contraction, those jobs that are quote unquote safe, because they are jobs where you can work remotely, may not actually be safe from an economics perspective.
Which I know is grim. I do wish we could tell you otherwise. If you've got a question or two or three about something in this month's jobs report, ask us about it. The place you can do that is marketplace.org. I mean, honestly, this whole thing could be a screenplay, right? A couple of months ago, maybe? A virus that's not fully understood, a global pandemic, countries shutting down. It's almost formulaic, you know? Now, it's reality. And the virus, having already affected Hollywood production schedules, is affecting content, too. Look for coronavirus-themed shows about love and loss and social distancing. But honestly, is anybody going to want to watch that? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Netflix has just signed on for a series called Social Distancing, produced by Junji Cohen, creator of Orange is the New Black. And Disney's cable channel, Freeform, plans to produce a romantic comedy called, wait for it, Love in the Time of Corona, filmed using remote technology. But Hollywood is divided, says Peter White with Deadline magazine. He says creators are unsure audiences will show up to watch what they're already living through.
People are trying to work out whether they're going to be wanting to lean into this or whether they're going to actually try and avoid it. Tone is a thing that a lot of people are talking about.
Tone, meaning do you make a comedy about a pandemic? This is not the first time Hollywood has had to figure out how to keep Americans entertained through rough times. During the Great Depression, films showcased Shirley Temple, Fred Astaire, and Ginger Rogers tap dancing into American hearts. But Professor Emily Carman from Chapman University says in those hard times, Americans also wanted to see films about underdogs, working class heroes, and gangsters.
You're the last guy in the world. I tried to cross you, know that. You wouldn't do anything to me. Don't take me, Tony. Give me a chance.
There was an allure with those kind of outlaw rebel figures.
Like the original Scarface, it was graphic and controversial, but people loved it. Now Hollywood is forced to innovate again. The few productions moving forward will be inventing a genre with some pretty experimental, untested technology. And we'll see how it goes. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
We've got a global pandemic in a global economy, so we are making some calls to people who are making a go of it, not here. It's for our series, What's Up, World?
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, world?
Of the places dealing with the coronavirus, which is most of the places, Taiwan is among the most successful. It's seen only a fraction of the cases other countries have, a much lower death total, and so the Taiwanese economy hasn't been shut down the way ours and a whole lot of others have, although that's not to say it's business as usual. Arvin Chen is an American filmmaker. He is based in Taipei, Taiwan. Arvin, thanks for coming on.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Good, thanks. And how's it going with you, I guess, is the question, right? When you go out and you're out and about, what does it look like on the ground there?
You know, it's I describe it as disturbingly normal. You know, like I live in Taipei in the downtown area, and you know, besides people wearing face masks and, you know, occasional temperature checks and some sanitizer spray when you walk into certain restaurants, you know, in stores, it's pretty much life is normal, which is, again, disturbing, but I guess slightly comforting.
Yeah, I get that on both counts. Back up for a minute. When you walk into a restaurant, so you can actually go and sit down and have a meal, yeah?
All restaurants are pretty much open here. Public transportation is up and running. Stores are open. I mean, we never had a full lockdown here. There is like social distancing where, like, you know, seating has changed and stuff like that. But more local restaurants, it looks pretty much exactly as it always did.
Near as you can tell, the economic impact has been what?
I think compared to the U.S., which is my closest comparison that I can make because my family still lives in the U.S., not that bad, you know, like people still go to work, not that many work from home cases. I think the thing that's really been hit hard is tourism. Like, you can't enter Taiwan unless you're a national. And even if you're a national, you get quarantined for 14 days. So there's no tourism.
Let's talk about you for a minute. You're a director, you're a filmmaker. What has this done to you?
I was supposed to shoot a movie here in April, and that's not happening anytime soon. These movies are smaller budget, so we do shoot in like actual locations, meaning we need to rent out, you know, restaurants and hotels and hospitals. So I think people are still very weary of, you know, 50 to 100 crew members coming into locations. So for me personally, as a director, that all that stuff is on standby right now, where we're just going to see how it is. Like every month we kind of like could, you know, get, should take a look at it and see like, is it going to get better? Is it going to get better where like we can feel like we can produce again? I also do some work in LA, back in the States as like a writer. So that stuff in a weird way hasn't stopped. And it's probably even picked up a little bit more because all you can do right now is develop and write. So I guess physical production, you know, directing, stuff like that has basically put on hold. But then the writing stuff, you know, developing projects, that stuff has been moving, if nothing else, even faster.
Is there talk in Taiwan of things getting back to normal? I mean, some of the talk here, as I'm sure you know by talking to your family, there's going to be like a new normal, right? So what's that conversation in Taiwan?
I mean, I think in Taiwan, it's always been this, you know, we've never had it. Again, the outbreak hasn't been that bad where people really had to stay at home completely. So I think that never really hit us here yet. And I think the new normal for most people is just that, okay, well, face masks are going to have to be a constant now. And probably, you know, certain types of hygiene, social distancing, stuff like that is going to be a constant. But I think the U.S. is going to have, I mean, it's definitely going to have a harder time adapting to whatever that new normal is, if there is going to have to be a new normal.
Right. Arvind Chen, he's a filmmaker, director. We got him in Taipei, Taiwan. Arvind, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
And thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, one last tidbit from today's jobs report. Maybe you heard Martha Gimbel mention this in that piece about the diffusion index. I do kind of love this. I got to tell you, central bank geek that I am. The fastest growing part of the American labor force last month in percentage terms, monetary authorities slash central bank. I mean, it's just 100 jobs, but still pretty apt given our times, yeah? Okay, we got to go. This quick ender for you, though, your moment of economic context in these turbulent times. We did a story maybe a couple of months ago, maybe longer actually, because who knows, about how women were for the first time the greater part of the out-of-the-house workforce in this economy. Yeah, that brief moment is over. Women got hit way harder than men did by all those April job losses. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Wear a mask. All those good things. Right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.